From the City of Angels, near the Pacific Ocean, good morning, good evening, wherever you may be, across the nation, around the world. I'm George Norrie. Welcome to Coast AM. Later tonight, lucid dreaming. Get ready for that. Here's what's happening. Israel's health ministry said it found a small number of heart inflammation cases observed, mainly in young men who received Pfizer's COVID-19 vaccine. Pfizer has said it has not observed the higher rate of condition known as myocarditis that would normally be expected in the general population. Most patients who experienced the heart inflammation spent no more than 4 days in the hospital, and 95% of the cases were classified as mild. Senator Rand Paul, Republican of Kentucky, shared two words in response to news of unearthed emails from Dr. Anthony Fauci. Thousands of emails obtained by BuzzFeed News and hundreds more reviewed by the Washington Post through the Freedom of Information Act. Requests show Fauci's responses to both critiques and high praise as he worked to communicate the dangers of COVID-19 to the U.S. Rand Paul said, "Told you." That's what he tweeted with a hashtag Fire Fauci. Paul has repeatedly criticized Fauci on social media and in interviews for his comments on herd immunity, wearing masks even after getting the COVID-19 vaccine, and his dismissal of a theory suggesting that COVID-19 may have originated from the Wuhan Institute of Virology in China that has now gained more credibility among members of the media in recent weeks, despite early snubbing of the idea. December 2019, I said it was out of the lab. I'm standing by it. President Biden has declared June a national month of action to take aim at the coronavirus pandemic, urging Americans to get vaccinated, aiming to reach his goal of getting at least one COVID vaccination shot in the arms of 70% of the nation's adults by July 4th. The president unveiled a five-part plan to reach that goal, which included steps to make it easier to get the vaccine and incentives such as free food, beer, and tickets. Top cybersecurity officials warning that the U.S. can expect to see more ransomware attacks as the nation reels from recent hits on U.S. interests, including meat supplies and fuel. Here's Howard Bloom to connect on this story. Howard, this is bizarre.
It's disturbing. Since at least 2007, America has been under hidden attack by cyber criminals in Russia, and the attackers have a crucial ally, Vladimir Putin. Many of the attacks on us we never hear of. For example, there have been 40 cyber attacks on food companies in the last year alone. These attacks threaten our national security, something that became obvious Sunday when the computer servers of the world's biggest meat processing company, JBS, were ground to a halt by hackers. Now, JBS is more important to your life and mine than you might think. It's a Brazilian global meat processing giant that owns the Swift brand, that operates in 15 countries, that provides a fifth of the world's meat supply, and that feeds Americans almost a quarter of our red meat. The JBS attack shut down 5 plants in the United States, 47 facilities in Australia, and 1 JBS plant in Canada, which means that the JBS attack threatened to drive up food prices and to rock your food security and mine. Then there was the attack May 6th on America's biggest gas pipeline, the Colonial Pipeline, that provides 45% of the fuel to the eastern USA. There was the attack on the U.S. Agency for International Development last Thursday that ordered the agency's computers to email malware to 3,000 individuals affiliated with Organizations for International Development, Humanitarian Aid, and Civil Rights. And there was the SolarWinds hack in late 2019 that allowed Russians to infiltrate the computers of over 100 companies and 9 federal agencies, including the Department of Defense. These attacks have something in common. Russia, for example, the attack on the U.S. Agency for International Development last Thursday appears to have come from a group called Cozy Bear, run by Russia's official Foreign Intelligence Service and active in America's 2016 presidential election. And the JBS meat attack came from a Russia-linked hacker collective called Our Evil. The current administration saw this coming and issued an executive order May 12th to radically upgrade our cybersecurity, but that won't be easy. Why? To understand Russia's campaign of sabotage against us, you have to know two facts. Fact number one, Since at least the 1980s, Russia has been waging a form of warfare against the United States and our allies at the Soviet Union's infamous spy agency, the KGB, way back when, called Active Measures. Active Measures means attacking us by means other than bombs and bullets, attacking us in what the Russians call political warfare. And Active Measures has taken on a whole new meaning in the cyber age. Today, Active Measures means feeding us disinformation, setting us at each other's throats, attacking our infrastructure. Then there's the fact number two. Russia has the biggest mafia in the world. It uses its criminal underground as special forces for its army and spy services. The deal goes like this. The Russian mafia and hackers get safe haven as long as they attack America and its allies, and as long as they advance the goals of Vladimir Putin, which means that if push comes to shove, these Russian state-supported cyber criminals can shut down our water, our electricity, our fuel, our food, and our internet. In case of war, they can render us paralyzed.
And they're testing us, Howard. They're testing us, to be sure. Howard Bloom, thank you so much. Israel's opposition leader moved closer to unseating Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu when he officially told the country's president that he has reached agreements with political allies to form a new government. Netanyahu's days are numbered. The Federal Reserve has announced that it will begin winding down a program that purchased tens of billions of dollars of corporate assets to shore up the economy during the pandemic. In a statement, the central bank said the facility was crucial to businesses during the depth of the recession, but as the economy rapidly recovers, the time to start winding it down has begun. Let's check in with Mish Sedlock, our investment advisor. Do you think this is good to dump this program, Mish?
Absolutely. It was illegal from the start. But let's discuss the ridiculous headline that came out today. CNN business headline was, the Fed will start winding down a program that saved the economy. The Fed's balance sheet, George, is $7 trillion. These corporate programs here that we're talking about, they bought corporate bonds, I believe, illegally, is about $13 billion in one program and then another $8.5 billion of exchange-rated ETFs. So $25 billion or so if you add all of this up versus a balance sheet of $7 trillion did not save the economy, and it was illegal. But the scary part about it is no one challenges them on this illegal stuff, George. You know, They do it. And yes, and then in a small dose, guess what's going to happen? They're going to do it bigger and bigger, and well, they've got authority because they've already done it. You know, what's next? Look ahead. I expect in the next downturn, they're probably going to be buying stocks. That's outside their mandate, too. Meanwhile, I had a look at Biden's budget. He released it on Friday going into Memorial Day weekend, kind of a strange time. You wonder what they're hiding. So you dig into it, and they're predicting, Biden's predicting a two-year a growth of this year 5.2%. Okay, I'll buy that. And next year 4.3%. But if you look ahead, the next 8 years are all under 2%. So what's going on here? Is this all that a $6 trillion budget, the biggest in history, is going to do for the country is get us pretty much stagnant growth around 2% for the next 8 years after this runs out? That's what we're looking at. And that assumes, George, no recession. What are the odds, George?
Well, I tell you what, Mish, it's going to be a tough presidential election when the 24 comes along, and we'll see what happens. NASA has announced plans to launch two new scientific missions to Venus between 2028 and 2030, its first in decades, to study the atmosphere and features of Earth's so-called sister planet. Up next, Not of This World, Mark Carlotto back on Coast to Coast as we talk about an emerging picture of the UFO phenomenon. And welcome back to Coast, George Norrie with you. Mark Carlotto back with us, aerospace engineer with more than 30 years' experience in satellite imaging, remote sensing, image processing, and pattern recognition. He received a PhD in electrical engineering from Carnegie Mellon University back in 1981, has published numerous technical articles and books. His latest, of course, is Not of This World, which we'll talk about in a moment. Dr. Carlotto contributed extensively to the investigation of the face on Mars and other structures in the Cydonia region of Mars, analyzed anomalous objects in the STS-48 and 80 space shuttle videos, and participated in a recent study of unusual surface features on the far side of the moon. Mark, welcome back, and very thorough job with this book, Not of This World. Great job.
Thanks a lot, George. I appreciate that.
How have you been?
I have a little bit of a head cold. I took my mask off, and I got a cold.
It got you, huh?
It got me, but otherwise I'm doing well. How about you?
That's good. Everybody's doing good here at Coast to Coast Land, and looking forward to this tonight. By the way, you really got into this in a big way with Richard Hoagland giving you some input, too, right, years ago.
Yeah, you know, that's how this book got started. I mean, so many things got started with Dick back in those days. Some things, well, like this book, I kind of put it on hold for a while. I kind of got away from it. And it was only recently I got back into it, you know, like more than 20 years ago. But, yeah, I mean, Dick got me into the into the shuttle videos. Oh, we can probably talk about that some more later. He found some interesting stuff, and then he kind of turned me on to it, and I found some other stuff. I think, you know, it's one of the early cases that I felt was pretty compelling.
Well, your work is very relevant because there's so much UFO talk out there these days, and there's, my gosh.
I know, and it's, you know, it's like an echo chamber. It's the same stuff just reverberating around. And, so I'm hoping to at least try to introduce some new facts. They're probably not, you know, super, super sexy. A lot of it is statistical, but I think it establishes a baseline that we can begin to look at this as a phenomenon that's existed for, you know, a very long time. And there's lots of cases that have been reported. And I think there's a lot of analysis that we can still do. We don't have to wait, you know, to hear from the government. I mean, I'm certainly curious about that, but I think researchers can do quite a bit with the data at hand, but there doesn't seem to be a whole lot of interest in that. It seems a lot of it is, you know, it's a very sensational topic, as you know, and but I'm trying to approach it a little bit in a more measured way.
Well, you're doing a great job doing that. When you were last with me, September of 2020, we talked about your book, Before Atlantis. Now this one, yeah. Of course, which I just think the timing for this is perfect. Everybody in Congress should get a copy of this, Mark.
Well, you know, it kind of, in a strange way, it kind of supports what a lot of people have been saying. You know, the government haven't said a whole lot, but they don't believe that UFOs are extraterrestrial. And, you know, I think that's intended to sort of dismiss the phenomenon. But to me, I think the extraterrestrial hypothesis is probably the least interesting. I think there's more other hypotheses that are more interesting, and that's, I kind of get into that a little bit at the end of the book, basing my thoughts on some of the data that, I looked at and others, the work that the Luis Elizondo people that are working with him and others that are studying UAPs now have come up with some really amazing analysis, not just of the Tic Tacs, but the Aguadilla, Puerto Rico video, video released by the Chilean Navy. So there's quite a few videos out there that are really, really remarkable.
Why do you think, Mark, things are starting to pop now, or at least it appears that they are?
So, I just posted an article on my blog, noteofthisworldufo.com. And what I do is I look at the last 80 years of historical data. This is from the National UFO Reporting Center that Peter Davenport is steward of.
Yeah.
It's an excellent site. And the data is just, it's in a form, it's amenable to analysis. I did analysis using some fairly simple tools, you know, Excel spreadsheets, if you will. I mean, it's and so people, if they're curious, they can do some pretty remarkable stuff with the data, because it's a good sample set. It's 90,000 reports.
Anyway, to answer your question, if you look at the data historically, the last 80 years, and you plot it out, it's actually, there have been peaks and valleys. It's gone up, you know, it went up around 20, or it went down 2015, then it went up again. And, you know, it's sort of like these short-term trends that we've been talking about. But if you look at it over 80 years, it's actually growing exponentially.
Well, that's true. That's absolutely true. This book, is it safe to say, is different from a lot of other UFO-type books?
Well, you know, I think it is because I'm not doing a lot in terms of human, witness reports or case studies. It doesn't really focus on the human dimension, which is really important. I don't do it doesn't mean it's not important. It's just right. Not my thing. What I try to do is try to pick up where some have started looking at the physics of, you know, measuring the velocities and accelerations. And, I look at a little over a dozen reports in detail, and I compare them against these observables that Elizondo comes up with, and in order to try to come up with some criteria. And I think I'm trying to approach it a little bit more systematically and more fact-based. And from that, I sort of turn the crank and I ask the question, okay, does this appear to be a real physical phenomenon? Does it exceed our current aerospace capabilities? I mean, some of these are obvious answers. Does it exceed the laws of physics as we know them? And then, you know, I think the key question is, are they extraterrestrial in origin? And so I kind of go about this in that whole area of SETI I explore using the Drake equation and some of the ideas that have been introduced by the SETI community, the principle of mediocrity, about where we stand in this galactic community and so forth. And, you know, sort of turning the crank, you come up with some answers and it's like, it doesn't really, and we can talk about this some more later, perhaps in more detail, but when you crack through the numbers, it just doesn't appear to support an extraterrestrial hypothesis. Something else is going on.
Well, then, you know, what do you think of this possibility? Because some people have talked about, Mark, that, you know, we are the Martians. What if the Martians are us? What if a million years ago we had this incredible technology on this 4.5 billion-year-old planet and got to Mars with the civilizations, and then something happened and everything was just seemed to be cut off or destroyed? Is that conceivable?
You know, that's I've sort of split my brain in half. That was the idea. That's consistent with some of the ideas I discussed in Before Atlantis, which was the book on ancient civilizations that we talked about back in the fall. And that's, you know, what I tried to do with that is sort of look at the possibility of previous civilizations on Earth without invoking an extraterrestrial hypothesis, that these were previous civilizations, earlier human subspecies. And I think there is a case to be made for just that, George, that not necessarily Homo sapien, but technologies have existed on Earth for a very long period of time, and it's possible that in the distant past we could have gone to Mars. And in fact, I have another recent post on beforeatlantis.com that sort of picks up Hoagland's hypothesis back in the 80s about alignments on Mars, and South African researcher, Wayne Herschel, who is big into star maps and correlations of star patterns on the ground and things that he found on Mars. And there's evidence on Mars to actually support what you suggest, that perhaps we did go to Mars, on the order of 200,000 to 300,000 years ago, which is consistent with some of this earlier, human civilization hypothesis that I talked about in Before Atlantis. But, you know, so in Before Atlantis, I kind of pursue that without the invoking extraterrestrials. It's like it's just us. And now in not of this world, it's I'm allowing that other possibility in, not extraterrestrials, but something else. So I kind of feel like sometimes I'm a little, you know, sort of split brain. I'm thinking about things in two different ways. I think what I'm trying to do is bound the problem, because I think the solution is somewhere in between.
It could be. Mark, we're going to take a quick break. We'll come back and chat more. His book, Not of This World, website's linked up at coasttocoastam.com. And welcome back to Coast, George Norrie back with you along with Mark Carlotto. Mark, the videos of STS 48 and 80 from the space shuttle, absolutely staggering. How can people deny the existence of these objects by looking at this tape? I mean, it's obvious something's going on there.
Well, you know, back then, the alternative explanation, the prosaic explanation, was that these are ice particles, right?
Right. And, like they said with John Glenn back in, during his mission.
Right. But, you know, the problem is with John Glenn, we didn't have any video.
Exactly.
But, you know, with this video, we're able to analyze it. You know, people claimed it was a Star Wars experiment, that it was, you know, there was some really extraordinary things going on.
What do you think? What's your gut tell you?
So I think, and the book really got started back then because I was convinced that this was the best evidence that I had seen, because we were dealing with video data, so we're tracking things, and we were able to measure accelerations. And, you know, these trajectories are moving around the Earth, so they're not like short, you know, traveling short distances. They're traveling, you know, thousands of kilometers in a short period of time, and they're moving at velocities that, you know, are several times orbital velocity and accelerating at rates that would crush a human. And, you know, at that point in time, it's like, well, we don't have anything to compare it to. We didn't have, you know, Tic Tacs and, you know, reports like that. So, you know, at the time it was like, okay, this is interesting, but I don't really think I could make a case. And so I kind of just decided to drop it at that point. And it was really when the UAP stuff came out that it's like, I think we really need to go back and start looking at these other cases, these other videos. You know, I reread Bruce McAbee's work on the Gulf Breeze sightings.
Yep.
And, you know, he finds some, you know, Elizondo talks about these, you know, lack of signatures, things taking off, going from zero to several times the speed of sound in a fraction of a second, no sonic boom. And, you know, Bruce observed this, it was Ed Walters, you know, observed this kind of behavior back in Gulf Breeze. So, you know, we have, it's not just one case now. We're starting to get, if we start looking at the historical data, there's patterns that are emerging.
Absolutely. But back to the space shuttle videos, it truly does not look like ice crystals to me.
No, it didn't to me. And but again, it's you know, when you're dealing with things that are only a few pixels in size in some cases, it's hard to make the case. Actually, it's interesting. Towards the end of the STS 48 video, the camera pans down and it captures a triangular vehicle of some kind traveling below the shuttle. You know, and of course, you know, no mention was ever made of that. But then remarkably, I mean, STS-48 wasn't the only video. There are several others that you know, appear to show spheres, space balls, if you will, literally materializing out of nowhere in the field of view of the shuttle's camera. And when you analyze the geometry of the lighting and, you know, and so forth, it's like, well, there's no way it's moving out of a shadow. And, you know, in some cases, objects are moving and then they stop. Well, how can something stop? And then there's STS 80, which I think is the most unusual.
Oh, my God. I just watched that today before you came on again. I mean, that was unbelievable.
Yeah, and no one's ever talked about that. And, you know, I had done an analysis of that back in the 90s. I tried to get it published, and it was like, you know, forget it. No way. They didn't believe the accelerations involved, but you know, now with tools like Google Earth, I can take that imagery, and I do this in the book. There's actually an article also on the blog where I talk about this. You can actually map it, the imagery down on the ground, and you can measure how far this thing moves per unit time, you know, per, you know, per interval of time, and the acceleration is unbelievable. It's moving as fast as a bolt of lightning.
It's unbelievable. Has anybody ever interviewed those shuttle astronauts on those missions?
Yeah, you know, it's Story Musgrave is a spokesperson along with Jim Oberg. He made an interesting statement where he said something like, "My stance, of course, is that life is on trillions of planets. Some of it is advanced enough to be doing star travel, but my interpretation of the evidence for visitation is that there is no evidence, that is none by anybody." So it's like, again, you sort of have this weird contradiction that, you know, SETI scientists, mainstream scientists say there's trillions of planets out there, that the galaxy is teeming with life, with advanced life, but there's no evidence for visitation. UFOs are just, you know, a figment of our imagination. It's like, huh? Doesn't make any sense.
Mark, tell us about the sighting over the dome in Jerusalem and its significance.
I think more people need to look at these videos. I just watched a new one that I hadn't seen today, where someone put together a composite where they take they sort of line up the videos. There's actually four. They had three of the four, but there were four observers north and south of the old city, looking towards Temple Mount. And the Western Wall. And what happens is, what these videos appear to show is an object descending from an undetermined altitude to a point west of the Western Wall, and then it moves eastward towards the Dome of the Rock. And at that point, it emits several bright flashes, and then it takes off. It moves up at an incredible speed. It's out of sight, and literally a fraction of a second. And you see the same thing on all of these videos. So it's really hard to, people have said, well, you know, these are all faked. And of course, you can always say that it's all faked. I don't believe anything. But, you know, four videos taken by different people from different locations is pretty compelling evidence. What's remarkable about this sighting is that it seems to move as fast as the Tic Tacs. It accelerates at you know, on the order of 1,000 G-forces, which would crush, not only would crush a human occupant, any kind of biological organism, but, you know, any sort of physical device would be crushed by, you know, from its own inertial mass. So, you know, how this could be, you know, anything, you know, that we're developing, or the Chinese or the Russians, is kind of blows my mind that could possibly be the case. It's, I think, something completely different. And it's a similarity with, again, getting back, you know, it's getting similarity with the Tic Tacs and with other sightings that I think makes it compelling, because it's not, you know, there is a context. These things are happening, and these videos are remarkable. They're taken by, you know, average people on cell phones, and it shows something really remarkable happening.
Mark, in Chapter 9, you devote a section to the politics of SETI. What are your thoughts on that organization?
So SETI is, there's an equation that it's called the Drake equation that...
Frank Drake, right?
Yeah, right. He came up with this to kind of explain the whole rationale for SETI. You know, why are we doing it? What are the assumptions? And the Drake equation, it's supposed to estimate the lifetime or the number of communicating civilizations, communicating by means of radio. And one of the terms is the lifetime of such a civilization. So how long, you know, a civilization that develops radio would last? What would it be? 10 years? 100 years? 1,000 years? And so it's sort of a formalism for coming up with some sort of numbers. But, you know, when you come right down to it, the first few terms, you know, in the equation, talk about the number of possible habitable planets and so forth, is probably something that astrophysicists can answer, because we're starting to look at exoplanets now and getting more data. But as you move, you know, down the equation, things become really more speculative. Like, you know, what's the lifetime of a communicating civilization? You know, we really don't know, but we know, you know, we know our own. And so with that as a data point, you say, okay, well, we haven't, and I don't, people may or may not realize this, but we haven't detected a signal. So, you know, by according to the principle of mediocrity, we're not exceptional. We're sort of, you know, in the curve of civilizations. You know, we have like a C average. We're in the middle somewhere. And so, you know, there's going to be civilizations out there that are using radio, some that may be evolved beyond radio. And by radio, I mean, you know, electromagnetic energy, radio, microwaves, light, things of that sort. And so, you know, some people say, well, maybe the, you know, the ETs are way more advanced and they're not using radio. Well, that's true. There, you know, perhaps there are some out there like that. But according to the principle of mediocrity, which is what SETI is based on, there should be emitting civilizations like our own. And yet we, after 60 years, we haven't detected anything. It's not like, and it's not like we haven't looked. We haven't detected anything. So if you want to follow the data, this says that we haven't detected any civilizations, any communicating civilizations, which would tend to suggest that there aren't a lot out there. I'm just, you know, just sort of following the facts.
What would you,
what you can also do with the Drake equation, this is sort of a bottom line, I'll try to get to it quickly, is you can also compute the probability or the number of space-faring civilizations. And if you use this number of SETI, the number of sightings that we have, the UFO sightings, that suggests that it's almost easier to build a spaceship than it is to build a cell phone. And it's sort of a ridiculous argument, but it sort of turns SETI on its head, because SETI can't believe in UFOs, because if it does, it undermines their overall rationale for SETI as a scientific endeavor.
Exactly.
And I think that's the problem.
I think so, too. I know Seth Shostak well. He's a great guy, but he will not admit that UFOs are visiting us or out there, but he will say that he believes there's intelligent life in the universe.
Yeah. Yeah, as soon as you admit that there's UFOs, it's like, okay, then that, if you plug that into the Drake equation, then it leads to a contradiction. And so SETI scientists cannot believe in UFOs.
Then they question, why are you listening if you don't believe in UFOs, right?
Right. It's crazy.
In your opinion, can we rule out Russian or Chinese craft?
You know, the book sounds, you know, after I finished it, I looked at it, it's like, you know, I'm pretty sort of, I sort of have one, major take on this phenomenon. But I think it's more, I think in reality it's complicated. I think there's a lot going on. I think there can be, I'm sure we have advanced technologies. I'm sure the other superpowers do as well. That could account for some of the sightings. And there could be extraterrestrials. I'm not discounting that, that possibility. But I think the sort of the big unknown, capital U, is something else. But yeah, I mean, I think some, you know, they talk about some of these triangles. It's the, what I can't remember the model number. Is it the TR3 or something? You know, the triangle that they've been talking about for years now that uses a magnetic vortex, like a mercury type of thing, to create a gravity dampening field. And they use that, then some propulsion, conventional propulsion with that to maneuver, and using that to try to explain some of the triangle sightings. And, you know, I mean, that's totally, you know, feasible, possible. I can't rule that out, but I don't know how anyone would make a Tic Tac, these cigar-shaped, Tic Tac crafts that they've been sighting with increasing frequency, that move in ways that they're not ballistic. You know, it's like Jacques Vallée talked about, you know, UFOs as sort of being like a hologram with mass. You know, it's like you're moving like you're moving a laser pointer around. It's that sort of thing. And clearly, we don't have that kind of technology.
No,
I mean, that's beyond physics. As It's even beyond Star Trek physics.
I mean, these Navy pilots recorded under the Tic Tac videos clearly were in shock with what they were trying to chase.
Yeah. And I think our society makes it really hard for people to be honest about this stuff. I mean, we should be, humans are explorers, and we should be interested in this topic, and we should be trying to understand it rather than ridicule it and make people feel like they're crazy. So I think it's a disservice. In the media, I think the mainstream media does a lot to belittle it because it's probably the fear, response kicking in, and you sort of, laugh about it and talk about those crazy UFO enthusiasts and so forth. Respected, magazines talking about it in very sort of sophomoric terms. So it's quite a sophisticated field, and I think we should take these reports seriously.
Absolutely. I think that's starting, though. Don't you feel that?
I think so. I think that they're listening, but the response right now in terms of so there's a lot of data out there, but there isn't a lot of information. We don't have a lot of knowledge. We haven't really processed it. We don't really have any ideas. So, for example, let's say, the government makes this big disclosure tomorrow, and the Washington Post or the LA Times calls leading SETI scientists and say, okay, what do you think about this? They don't have an answer. They haven't thought about this. No one's really thought about this.
They'll be in shock as everybody else will. Stay with us, Mark. We're going to take a quick break. We'll come back and chat more. And take phone calls with you. Mark Carlotto with us, his book, Not of This World.